deconstructing psyops, propaganda, and mainstream media garbage. Pella Neroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
And welcome back to the Pella Neroth-Taylor Show with me, Basil Valentine, sitting in for Pella today, Thursday, the 16th of May, 2024. Indeed, we do try and deconstruct psyops here on today's News Talk. And there's no bigger one, except it's more than just a psyop, than the attempted assassination of Slovakian Prime Minister Robert Fico yesterday. Reuters is reporting that the suspect in Fico's assassination attempt acted alone and had previously taken part in anti-government protests. I'm not quite sure how, after less than 24 hours, a news agency can be so certain that he acted alone. We were told that about a certain Lee Harvey Oswald over 60 years ago, and he had nothing whatsoever to do with the shooting of the president. In fact, he was trying to warn the president because he was aware that he was being manoeuvred into position and wasn't really very surprised when he emerged as the patsy, as he famously said, while being dragged across the Dallas police station before being murdered himself. So Reuters nevertheless seem to think they know that the suspect acted alone. He had previously taken part in anti-government protests, according to the country's interior minister. He suggested that the suspect disagreed with the government's justice and media policies and that the attack was premeditated. According to the Associated Press, Matus Sutaj Estok described the suspect as a lone wolf who did not belong to any political groups. That's none that we know of, anyway. Fico himself is apparently in a stable condition, but not out of the woods yet, according to officials. And a man, as yet unidentified, has been charged with attempted murder. Robert Kaliňák, the Deputy Prime Minister and Defence Minister of Slovakia, has said that Fico is too early to say, but that the outlook is positive. And Peter Pellegrini, the President-elect of the country, has said that Fico has been able to speak in hospital. Manuel Mikel Simeka is the leader of the opposition Progressive Slovakia, and he said the attack on the Prime Minister is an attack on democracy. Most of all, we now need to end the spiral of attacks and blame. We must all contribute to this in our own way, both as politicians and as citizens. Katarina Roth-Nevedalova is a member of the European Parliament representing the Slovakian district of Smer, and her contribution is as follows. I hope that this assassination attempt taught us that all politicians have to be more responsible in their speeches, activities and protests, and not call for harsh reactions. It would seem there that she might be suggesting Fico has brought this on himself. And The Guardian are reporting that this shooting could trigger a media crackdown. Editors fear. Journalists in Slovakia think the attempted assassination of Robert Fico could lead to even more polarization and a crackdown on independent voices. In the hours after Fico was shot yesterday, several senior politicians from the ruling coalition blamed independent media and the opposition for the incident. I don't see how media can be blamed for a shooting, but nevertheless, Lubos Blaha, the deputy speaker of the Slovakian parliament from the ruling Smer opposition party, said, "This is your fault. Because of you, liberal media, the four-time Prime Minister Robert Fico, the most significant statesman in Slovakia's modern history, is currently fighting for his life." Andrej Danko, the leader of the Slovak National Party, which forms part of the governing coalition, also blamed media outlets and the opposition, and senior government ministers repeatedly criticized journalist coverage at a press conference earlier today. Media freedom has indeed been the subject of extensive discussion in Slovakia over the past weeks, with Fico's government moving forward with a controversial proposal to replace the public broadcaster RTVS. Journalists say the Prime Minister, who has come under criticism for lashing out at independent media outlets and scrapping a special prosecutor's office, has been working to undermine media freedom. senior editors at leading Slovakian publications have told the Guardian newspaper that they are concerned about the impact of the shooting. Meanwhile, over at the International Court of Justice, there are emergency hearings to discuss a request by South Africa, which is seeking additional emergency measures over Israel's offensive on Rafah, the city in southern Gaza, where more than a million people are displaced. South Africa began presenting public oral arguments at the Hague Court at 1 p.m. GMT, and Israel is scheduled to provide its views tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. GMT. Irish barrister Bláin Nergalay has taken to the floor, and she opened by speaking in French. She said that in the light of the dramatic developments unfolding in the Gaza Strip, South Africa feels compelled once more to request your invaluable intervention. South Africa, she says, also calls on the court to modify or indicate new provision measures, in particular, and explicitly and immediately cessation of Israeli military operations in Rafah and elsewhere in the territory in order to protect and also prevent the total annihilation of what remains of the Gaza Strip of Palestine and its people. Previously, Professor Ungo Katayobi concluded his presentation by saying, the genocidal acts described in South Africa's initial application were foreseen and foreseeable from the onset. Israel's intent was always to destroy Palestinian life and to wipe them off the face of the earth. Rafah is the final stand. Without Rafah, there is no more Palestinian life in Gaza to speak of, no more Palestinian identity, and no possibility of reconstruction. The rule of law can only survive through the orders of this court. If the rule of the law is to have any meaning at all, let it be today and with this case. It is no longer enough to order unhindered access to humanitarian aid when it is in fact the military operation in Gaza that is preventing it. It is no longer enough to encourage compliance. The court needs to take firmer action. Israeli soldiers and officials understand that the goal is to destroy Palestinian life. Katayobi went through a series of statements by high-level Israeli officials, including the vice chairman of the global arm of Israel's leading Likud party, which he says show genocidal intent. He also displayed to the court a video of Israeli soldiers echoing such calls, including one of a group of soldiers shouting, let's go and destroy Rafah. The destruction of Palestinian life in Gaza is understood by Israeli officials and soldiers, he said. Members of the Israeli Ministerial Committee on National Security Affairs and the War Cabinet have, he said, simply continued with incitement to genocide. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has gone beyond any reference to Hamas alone. Instead, he has described Israel's aims in the military assault as being to ensure that Gaza will never again constitute a threat to Israel. Meanwhile, Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant has made it clear that Israel is taking apart neighborhood after neighborhood and will reach every location in Gaza. Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich has asserted there are no half measures. Rafah, Deir al-Balah, Nuseirat, total annihilation. The fourth feature of the genocidal conduct is, of course, the discovery of mass graves. In the targeted attacks on hospitals, Israel has killed hundreds of civilians, including doctors and medical staff, turning centers for healing into mass graves full of the decomposing bodies of men, women, and children. On April the 10th, the UN inspection team had reported that Khan Yunis was reduced to rubble and dirt, and returnees discovered ghastly scenes of unearthed mass graves containing the massacred bodies of the elderly, women, children, and men in the grounds of the Nasser Hospital. The fifth feature of the genocidal conduct relates to Israel's intensified attacks in the north, an area Israel reported where it had cleared many months ago. At least 100,000 people in the north had been forced to flee their devastated homes while Israel continued its assault on Rafah. We're going to do a very quick pivot in a few minutes when I'll be joined by Tammy Guthbert-Garcia. Tammy is a holistic nutritionist and a radio personality known for her diverse contributions across media platforms. She hosts a daily radio show and a weekly podcast. She's promoting her annual Naturally Inspired Health Summit. And the topic we'll be discussing is fighting medical enslavement through community converse. I'm very looking forward to talking to Tammy in just a few minutes, and we'll be right back after this short break.
Connecting the dots, painting the bigger picture.
They always have great conversation.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Very well, thank you, Tammy. Great that you can join us here on the Pelle.
Thank you.
I'm Basil Valentine, sitting in for Pelle today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk to your audience and to you.
Well, that's very, very kind of you to say so. Are you speaking to me from Loveland, Colorado right now?
No, I'm just south of Loveland. I'm from in Johnstown, Colorado, but very close, just a few miles down the highway.
Okay. It's not a part of the United States, I know. I'd be delighted if you could describe it briefly to our viewers and listeners.
Oh, yeah, sure. Colorado is beautiful. Very beautiful.
One word, but that'll do. Beautiful.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I wasn't sure if we were on here.
We are on.
I'm so sorry. Loveland, Colorado. Yeah. We're talking about the Front Range, the mountains. So it's absolutely beautiful here. We've had a great spring and summer, which is really interesting because last year we had a lot of rain. So we're loving it here.
Good. I'm very glad to hear it. You look very healthy. And the mountain air up there, I've no doubt, is extremely healthy as well. And you are a nutritionist, amongst other things. So what can the likes of me do two-thirds of the way through our lives to improve our health and look as vital and vibrant as you do, Tammy?
Well, first and foremost, diet is so important because we're eating every day. So whatever we put in our bodies is going to show up outside. And often we don't think about that. So what we can do is stop eating so much processed food. I mean, we eat so much processed food in our diet, and that is the first and foremost thing that we should be doing.
A lot of people don't have the time to cook from scratch, and I'm afraid to say that as someone who's increasingly busy these days, I've taken a vow not to buy anything that requires the use of a peeler at the greengrocer. So I'll peel a banana, but I don't have time or the inclination to peel carrots or turnips. Fortunately, one can buy pre-prepared vegetable these days. But ready meals, I guess, are out. I do like to cook from scratch, but can you think of any shortcuts for the likes of me whereby we can avoid processed food, but also not spend too long in the kitchen?
That's a good question, but I think it's an excuse, Basil. I'm very direct. I don't like to act or to be, you know, to sugarcoat things for people. So I think that's an excuse. I think that we find plenty of time to sit on Netflix, to scroll TikTok, to scroll Instagram. And so I think it's an excuse. And I think it's something that, you know, is a hard pill for people to swallow. But I think we have to commit to our health. It's the thing that we can't function when we're sick or dead, quite honestly. And our priority has become money. And being busy over our health. And we have to change that, Basil. We have to change that. We have to get real with ourselves.
Absolutely. Diet is one thing. What about exercise?
Sure.
We don't really seem to have the opportunity, a lot of us, on our day-to-day lives. I'm not one for pumping iron. I have made it into the swimming pool today. A short
Oh,
walk
that's
is generally
wonderful.
recommended. Give us a
Yeah.
few tips, please.
Well, actually, I don't like to bombard people with a whole bunch of things to do when they've decided to go on a health journey. I like to break it down and keep it simple. And honestly, it depends on your health goals. So if you're trying to lose weight, a lot of people think they can run off a bad diet. And what we should really focus on in the beginning is nutrition. You actually exercise is wonderful. It's great for your health, but it's not a good strategy to lose weight. A lot of people think it is, and that's what's got us into this kind of yo-yo dieting type of paradigm.
Absolutely. When I exercise, I just find I get more hungry, you know. So,
Well, that could be true. And that's why I think, people get caught into this cycle of trying to burn calories through exercise and achieve weight loss, when in reality, you have a lot more control about your calorie intake through nutrition. So you have to focus on, nutrient-dense foods rather than these empty, bag of chips, carbohydrate type foods.
So proteins, basically.
Yeah, proteins and fat. We've become paranoid about fat, and our bodies need fat. So in the 80s and 90s, it was all about no fat, low fat. And what that did was it got a lot of people hungry, because you're not feeding your satiety. You're not getting satisfied from the foods that you're eating. And so you're more easily to overeat.
Right. Simply filling up on
Yeah.
stodge, but fat-free stodge, as it were.
Yeah. And those products are often developed in laboratories. So what happens is, we see on the outside a picture of grandma. She's, stirring the pot, making these wonderful kettle chips. And in reality, these products have been made in a laboratory by scientists. They have, come together and tried to develop the best flavor punch they possibly can, so that our brains get that dopamine fix every time we eat them. And they tell us in their marketing, when they say, "I bet you can't just eat one." This is what this is all about. It's about selling products, not nutrition. So we have to tap out of that model and tap into foods that actually are nutrient dense, right? So meat, fat, vegetables, fruits, all the normal things
All the normal things that we used to eat before
we
pizza
used
arrived on
to.
the scene.
Yeah. Yeah.
United States, when I visited in recent years, one is struck by the number of very seriously obese people wandering around. I mean, some of them, what we would used to call morbidly obese. Now, I'm not one for fat shaming, but it seems that the normalization of extreme overweight has been to the detriment of the health of Americans in the final analysis. If you look at pictures of Americans on the beach in the 1960s and 70s, they're all slim. They might have been smoking a bit more, and maybe that suppressed their appetite.
Yeah, well, and it's kind of embarrassing to really be honest about what happened through COVID. The reason why people were so concerned about Americans is because of our rate of obesity. And I hate that to admit that about ourselves, but we now have to come to terms with the truth of our health. It's an epidemic. We're the sickest country, as a whole, that we've ever been, as a country. Our children are sick. It is time to change. And when you commit to community commerce when it comes to your health, real solutions for health, you're doing two things. You are tapping out of the corporate government collusion model, which is big pharma, big medicine, big food, and you're tapping into your community, and you're getting a better quality product when you do that. And you're getting a better contributing product to your health. But you're also sending a message to the marketplace that you're done with disease care. You're done with this model. And that's the way I think we can push back. We've obviously been under attack here in all globally, and we've tried voting people out, voting people in. It's not working. We've tried the legal system. You know, we've tried to get recourse on some of these injuries from these mandated injections. It's not going anywhere. The only place I think we're really going to make a difference is with our money, where we spend our money. If we can cut our adversaries off from our funnel of money, they're going to get the message. The marketplace is going to get better products, and we're going to get healthier.
I'm currently in France, Tammy, where, as you know, they have an altogether different relationship to food. And mm-hmm. the provenance where something was grown is all important here. Food generally travels much shorter distances. You can buy tomatoes and vegetables and meats and fish from mm-hmm. within a 10-kilometer radius of just about anywhere you are in France. And that's partly because French people will not accept the lower standards that it seems the British and the Americans are willing to do. Flavorless tomatoes, for example. Mm-hmm. So, go on.
I was going to say, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I always tell my clients, like, you get what you tolerate. And we need to learn that in this nation right now. So I'm originally from Canada. I was born and raised in Canada and moved to the United States legally. I noticed a real difference in the quality of food when I moved here. Yogurt didn't right. taste the same. Cheese didn't taste the same. And at the time, I was kind of perplexed by it. I was like, this is strange. I don't understand why it tastes different. But then as I became a mom, I started doing research and I realized, oh my goodness, there are actually ingredients in the food here in the United States that are illegal in Canada and illegal in the UK. Why are we as Americans putting up with toxic chemicals in our food? Why is it acceptable here? Because we get what we tolerate. And in this country, we've become more tied to monetary gain and influence and money and clout than we have to our health. And I don't know if this is news to anybody, but it might be to some people. You can't actually live a healthy life, live free when you're sick, disabled, or dead. So you can't put your money in front of your health.
No, I agree with you. And there's that mystery ingredient that seems it's find its way into 70% of everything on American shelves. High fructose corn syrup. Mm-hmm. We don't see it in Europe. What exactly is it and what does it do to people?
Well, you know, it's condensed sugar is what it is. And this is the problem that we have. So they just passed a new law in New York where they're going to label anything over 50 grams of sugar as a caution. They're going to put a caution label on it. This is laughable to me, Basil, because you shouldn't have 50 grams of sugar in a day, let alone in one food item. So it's kind of like, yeah, we're doing something, but they're not doing anything. You know, the recommended daily allotance for sugar for a woman is 23 grams, but that's, to me, still high. I mean, I like to see you keep it under 12 a day, because when you start, especially depending on your age, especially, but once you get older, you're dealing with these cortisol spikes, which also lead to obesity. So there's a lot of, you know, nuance to it and individuality when it comes to our diets, which of course this medical model doesn't allow for. It's a, you know, one-stop shopping for everybody. This is where we're starting to get into medical enslavement. It's going to affect our food as well. If the government can control what you eat and everybody has to eat the same way, we are going to find ourselves enslaved and very, very sick. So high fructose corn syrup, you know, corn is funded. It's a GMO crop. They spray it with glyphosate. Follow the money. These crops are being funded because they make money. It's a filler. Soy is a big crop here in the United States. It's a filler in a lot of foods. But yet, you know, we don't even acknowledge that soy has an impact, especially on our boys hormonally. And it's in everything. you start looking at soy and corn and, you know, saying, you know, I'm going to limit my soy and corn, you're going to become keenly aware quickly of how much soy and corn is in your diet. And that's contributing to disease, inflammation, which is the root of all disease, right? It's your body's response to toxins. People are inflamed and walking around with inflammation every day because of their diet.
We're going to take a short break now for the headlines. When we come back, I'm very keen to ask Tammy more about community commerce and can Americans break away from Walmart? We'll be right back after this short break.
TNT's Limbed Open.
I don't see myself as a prude. I don't think that I censor anyone, pretty much. But family entertainment should be exactly that. I don't expect family entertainment to be intensely sexualized and therefore inappropriate for the viewing with my six-year-old daughter. But that's what happened last night. The Eurovision Song Contest was infested by a lot of mediocre songs, but that's a matter of taste and certainly not offensive. But the UK entry, in my view, was disgusting. It was entirely sexualized, indicating sex acts, which I won't describe on air, with nothing left to the imagination, really. What I was concerned about is that my six-year-old didn't understand what was being portrayed and was confused by it. I turned over. I have to admit, I had low expectations, but despite that, I didn't expect to be appalled on behalf of her.
Limbed Open. And today's news talk, TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission. Today's News Talk Radio.
I do a lot of streaming radio.
I do a lot of free streaming.
tntradio.live.
And welcome back to the Pelle North Theatre Show with me, Basil Valentine, sitting in for Pelle. Today, Thursday, the 16th of May, and I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Tammy Garcia all the way from Loveland in Colorado, or very near there anyway. Tammy, from my recent trips to the States, it strikes me that American food is all about sort of gratification. Yes. You know, would you like cheese with that? it's about the sort of... Well, I hate to have to use the term, but the lowest common denominator in terms of satisfying American palates with both taste and quantity, and that Americans, in order to embrace community commerce, need to change their relationship with food
yes.
and not see sort of dough-based things like donuts and pizzas, for that matter, as being, yeah. you know, somehow... nutritionally adequate.
Yeah, I would agree with you, but I also think that Americans really just need to remember who they are. This is the Wild West, and we seem to have been conned out of that thinking. We seem to have been marketed to at nauseam in order to, you know, take the bait for convenience, for fast, for yes. quick. And I think, you know, even our egos have been weaponized against us in order with health, especially because just like you say, you know, people will tend to pick the instant gratification. They're doing that with their appearance as well, right? And with their ailments, they want quick fixes. And I think this is the strategy that people have brought upon America, specifically targeted because we are known for our grit. because we are known for innovation, because we are tough, because we are loud and not and unapologetic for it, I think that this has been a strategy globally to kind of, you know, dumb down Americans. And I think that once Americans wake up to that, they're going to have awakened a sleeping bear, because really this is what it boils down to, is a little bit of education. And I'm out here every single day educating Americans on this and to remind them who they are. They aren't fat, weak, sick, and medicated people by nature. They are warriors, and they are fighters, and they are innovators. And, you know, they fought for this land, and their ancestors fought for this land. We simply just need a little reminder about who we are. And when we wake up, I'd look out.
Well said, Tammy. Well said, Tammy. And finally, we've only got 5 minutes left. Tell our viewers and listeners more about community commerce. When I was in San Diego some years ago, we found a farmer's market with, you know, local growers bringing their genuine products in to sell directly to the public, real food for a change. But in a lot of the United States, I've also spent time in upstate Mississippi, where Walmart is unfortunately just about the only shop in town. It does seem that certain supermarkets have got a stranglehold on the sale and distribution of food, which makes it very difficult to break out of the processed food net. Please expand on community commerce.
Yeah, so we have these massive, you know, investment firms and corporations, BlackRock, Vanguard, as you know, they're eating up the marketplace, and you know, they're dominating. We're down to about 9 different companies that own 80% of the food supply. So, you know, on the shelf, and again, Americans are being tricked here. Wait till they wake up to this. On the shelf, you'll see a number of different brands, but in reality, most of those brands are owned by the same company or one of 9 of them. So that's what we're dealing with. And so once we wake up Americans to this and they understand that, you know, they're actually in a war, and one of many things are being used as weapons against the American people right now, but food is just one of them. Once they wake up to that and they tap into supporting their own people's businesses, they tap into community commerce and real solutions for health, then we're going to come back bigger and better than ever. And that's what we do at Naturally Inspired. This summer, June 1st, we have the Naturally Inspired Health Summit. This is the second year. And let me tell you, Basil, when we did the first one last year, we expected maybe a few hundred people. We had over 1,000 people there. This year, I expect to double that and maybe even more, because people are waking up every day and they're mad when they find out, you know, that they've been preyed upon, that this is kind of a weird war. It's not a kinetic war. It's actually a societal war. And they're using things like food and medicine to conquer our country and our citizens. They're going to come back in full force. And so we expect a huge turnout this year at the Naturally Inspired Health Summit, June 1st in Loveland, Colorado. Here's who's coming. You're not going to believe this lineup. Del Bigtree from The High Wire is going to be there. Oh, wow. So he's obviously a huge advocate for children and health. Joel Salatin, who is a regenerative farmer, probably our most famous regenerative farmer in our country. He has Polyface Farms. Dr. Lee Merritt, 10 years in the U.S. Navy military. She has been a warrior through COVID, sharing her message and real solutions for health. Dr. Henry E. Lee is going to be there. He's a naturopathic doctor, doesn't back down from anything, I tell you. He is bringing real solutions to people who have been injected and injured. And then we have American business owners like Bob Greska, who has developed a natural carbon 60 product to help people with pain relief. We have Gail Lynn from the Harmonic Egg, who's invented a light and sound healing device, which is absolutely amazing, helping kids with autism and ADD. We have Christy Hall, who's helping kids with nutrition and with things like ADD as well. And we so many more. Children's Health Defense is going to be there. Weston A. Price is supporting. This is going to be a fantastic event. So if you'd like to attend, go to naturallyinspiredhealthsummit.com today and secure your ticket. It's only $50 for a whole day, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. It's going to be fun, music, and real solutions for health.
Well, that sounds absolutely great, Tammy. I wish I could be there myself, but unfortunately not this year, maybe next. And finally, where can people find you and your writings and podcasts?
Awesome. Thank you for asking. People can go to contacttammy.com. That's contacttammy, TAMMY.com. And when they go there, they can connect to all my work, my radio show, my podcast, my Substack, and all of our events.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us today on today's News Talk, Tammy Garcia, and I look forward to talking to you again very soon.
Thank you so much, Basil. Have a wonderful day.
You too. There she goes. That's Tammy Garcia. We're going to take a second break with the network now, and when we come back, Aaron Cariati, Senior Brownstone Institute Counselor and a scholar at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. We'll be discussing his latest article, a topic very close to my heart, the latent fascism of today's so-called anti-fascists. We'll be right back after this short break.
I'm Naheem Hines, professional football player and proud supporter of the Muscular Dystrophy Association. My mom was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy when I was 14, and I watched her struggle. But MDA helped her get the best treatments and care, and they also help kids like my buddy Ethan.
My name is Ethan, and I'm 12 years old. Thanks to the Muscular Dystrophy Association and people like you, I have more hope than ever before. From day one, they've treated me like family at my local care center. MDA is the only one that funds over 150 care centers across the U.S. to help provide state-of-the-art care for adults and kids like me.
For over 70 years, MDA has been transforming the lives of people living with muscular dystrophy, ALS, and other related neuromuscular diseases. They fund the research for breakthrough treatments, care, and cures. And MDA provides support to thousands of families like mine and Ethan's in communities like yours. Thanks to MDA, kids and adults can live life to its fullest. Join us and learn more at MDA.org today.
Need a ride?
Yeah!
Driving with kids is a big responsibility.
Hop in and buckle up!
So don't sweat the small stuff.
You got paint all over our paper!
Get the big stuff right instead.
What does that mean?
Like making sure your kids are in the correct car seat and buckled up for safer travel.
That deserves a wiggly wiggly wig.
To make sure your child is in the right seat for their age and size, visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat.
Beep, beep. Yeah.
From the Cold War to propaganda and the deep state, Pella Neuroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
And welcome back to the Pelle North Taylor Show with me, Basil Valentine, sitting in for Pelle today, Thursday the 16th of May. One of the great things about this job is you get to meet people you admire, even if it is only virtually for 20 minutes. And one of those is Dr. Aaron Cariati, who is not only a physician, but a senior counsellor at the Brownstone Institute and a scholar of the Ethics and Public Policy Centre in Washington, D.C. His latest article, published on the Brownstone website at brownstone.org, is The Latent Fascism of Today's Anti-Fascists, a subject very close to my heart. Welcome to the program, Aaron.
Thanks, Basil. Good to be with you.
It's long since struck me that the real authoritarians are the globalists posing as centrists, likes of Tony Blair, Joe Biden. We see it across the world. And the only true libertarians are outside that narrow opinion corridor and ironically attacked as extremists. The whole thing's become inverted, hasn't it, Aaron?
That's right. It's a kind of brilliant inversion of political categories, which when they're applied in the way that you just described are virtually meaningless. You have a kind of extreme centrism where you get a merger of state and corporate power, which is the very definition of fascism, according to Mussolini, the Italian fascist, and his philosopher of fascism, a man named Gentile. And yet somehow words have taken on a kind of inverted meaning. They've been propagandized in a way that's very effectively confused people and made people operating in very extreme ways appear to be mainstream, and people resisting that characterized as fascists or whatever the sort of epithet or disparaging word you want to use might be.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a case in Germany this week where a court in Munster has decided that the AfD party, the Alternative for Democracy, Alternative for Deutschland, somehow pose a threat to democracy and need to be under government surveillance, even though they're running second in the polls. And they've even been called to ban the AfD to save democracy. I don't see how banning political parties in any way enhances democracy. Likewise, in the United States, you've got this absurd idea that Donald Trump is going to do away with democracy when, if anything, it's the Democrats that have been undermining it over the last 4 years.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Really, since 2016, populism has been characterized by global elites as a threat to, well, they say a threat to democracy, whereas in fact, it's a threat to their power. So whether it's the Brexit vote in the UK or the Donald Trump election in the United States, you know, we have to, quote unquote, protect democracy from the demos, from the people, from those voters who don't know what's good for them. And so you get a regime of surveillance, which you mentioned a moment ago. You get a regime of mass censorship on the internet, attempts by global corporations in cahoots with governments to control the flow of information online, right? Democracy is all fine and well, so long as people don't make decisions that the power elites don't like. And to prevent that from happening, we have to make sure that that the people only have access to the kind of information that we want them to see. And so you get authoritarian, fascist means of political control, from propaganda to mass surveillance to very sophisticated forms of internet censorship, deployed supposedly to save democracy, whereas in fact they're simply being deployed to solidify the power of people who are threatened by the fact that lots of ordinary folks don't like the direction that they're taking public life or political life.
Absolutely. And now we have these supranational organizations and institutions like the World Health Organization, the World Economic Forum, who seem to be, well, quite open, really, in their contempt for public opinion. They seem to have aggregated to themselves levers of power via corporations, everything from Microsoft, BlackRock, Vanguard, and you know, almost before our eyes over the last 25 years, we've moved, people would say, to oligarchy, but I would also say to plutocracy, because you can buy your way into power and into the upper echelons of decision making. You know, the likes of Elon Musk and Bill Gates seem to be operating effectively as heads of non-existent states, Aaron.
Yeah, that's right. Some commentators have called these multinational corporations governmentalities because they're exercising forms of power that seem to be able to do an end run around sovereign nation states that don't seem to respect borders or the local laws enacted by duly elected representatives. And as hapless or inept as, you know, some of our politicians might be, I would rather be governed by someone that I can vote out of office or vote into office than by someone who has gained power simply because they've amassed enormous amounts of wealth. So I think this trend is very dangerous. It's clearly a global phenomenon. It's not restricted to one or another country. If you look at something like the World Economic Forum, what is the WEF? It's a trade organization of the wealthiest corporations in the world. And what is an organization like that going to do? It's going to act in the interest of those wealthiest corporations in the world. It's not going to solve the world's problems. It's not going to propose political solutions to global issues. It's going to act to increase both the money and the power of those global corporations, which already one could argue, already exercise undue power simply because of their wealth and their reach.
You say in this very erudite essay on the brownstone.org website that the real political divide today is between perfectists and anti-perfectists.
Yeah,
I certainly think that the left-right paradigm, which you know we inherited really from the 19th century about the ownership of capital fundamentally and then various other social issues sort of woven into that left-right paradigm, I think that's completely redundant. And on the UK political scene, as in the United States, the uniparty is agreed about just about everything. I would venture to suggest that the real divide is between the sane and the insane, between people who want peace and people who want war, and also fundamentally between people like our last guest, Tammy Garcia, who sees society as reconvening on a community-based, ground-up basis, and
right.
others who want to continue the push down from the top.
Yeah, I agree completely. The left-right categories, political categories like liberal and conservative, don't really describe the realities on the ground or the divisions between two fundamentally different versions of society. And I agree, one of those is a decentralized version of society that respects local communities, that respects the rights of individuals and families to take care of most of the things that pertain to their well-being, with a light touch from distant entities like the nation state, which may be responsible for border security, may be responsible for defense, in the case of a foreign invasion and that sort of thing, but don't need to be governing the minutiae of our day-to-day lives. So a top-down centralized form of authority versus a decentralized distributed form of authority. I think that's the real political division today. And my remark about perfectism versus anti-perfectism, perfectism is any political solution that views utopia as just around the corner, right? If only we can amass enough power, if only we can get the right people into power, then the new birth of freedom and peace will be ushered in just around the corner. The most characteristic, I think, representative of this view is Marxism, right? After the proletarian revolution, the communist utopian society will be ushered in, the state will wither away, and we'll have a kind of heaven on earth. And I think the antidote to that is a modest view of politics, that our job is to try to minimize the evils in every age, knowing that we're never going to fully eradicate them. The aims of politics are therefore very modest, and we don't look to a political program or a social program to try to usher in heaven on earth. That's turning politics into a kind of religion, into a kind of God, always comes back to bite us and ends up being profoundly dehumanizing. And we have plenty of examples from the 20th century that we should have learned from, that it seems that we still haven't.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm not sort of utopian unrealist, but nevertheless, culturally, and indeed from these supranational organizations, we are presented with endlessly dystopian visions of the future. If you go to the cinema, the future is always projected as some kind of sort of nightmarish techno-fascist, anti-human reality. And I think we do need a vision for the future that is peaceful, prosperous, healthy, all the things that people naturally want. And what's more, with genuine plurality of opinion permitted, plurality of cultural expression, and where we can genuinely respect differences. Now, that doesn't seem to be the case with the way the corporate media work at the moment, which is that outside an accepted opinion corridor, you're off the reservation. And that includes a lot of us here on TNT.
Yeah, that's right. It's very important to recognize that this is the first and crucial move in the direction of totalitarianism. And when you mention the possibility of totalitarianism, it's easy for others to sort of dismiss you. Well, you know, that sounds overblown. We're still living in mostly free, open, democratic Western societies. You know, stop exaggerating the threat. But there was a political theorist of the 20th century, a man named Eric Voegelin, who studied the 20th century totalitarian systems, whether it was Italian fascism, Nazism, Soviet communism. And he said the common feature of all these systems and the starting point where they all begin is not concentration camps, you know, barbed wire fences. It's not secret police, men in jackboots. It's not even mass surveillance. As horrifying as all those things are, the central feature of all totalitarian systems is the prohibition of questions. The regime monopolizes what counts as knowledge, what counts as rationality. And if you raise your hand, like, you know, like you do on TNT radio, and ask any questions about what's going on that are inconvenient to the regime, they don't sit down and debate you. They don't sit down and argue with you. They simply shut you out of the realm of polite conversation through censorship, through various other forms of digital marginalization, where you're placed in a kind of, maybe not a literal gulag, but a kind of digital or informational gulag. And once a regime has been able to monopolize what counts as knowledge and rationality and prohibit anyone from questioning the regime, then the rest of the totalitarian apparatus will follow inevitably from that. And, you know, when that system is totally perfected, as Hannah Arendt pointed out, you no longer need as many of the external controls. You don't need concentration camps. You don't need secret police, because everyone is informing on everyone else all the time. And the ideology over time becomes increasingly internalized by the citizens, such that, you know, at the end point of that process, the questions no longer occur to people. Right. We have a kind of organized thoughtlessness where, you know, the idea that we could live differently, the idea that I don't have to put up with these kinds of infringements upon my life, simply doesn't occur to people anymore. They're kind of walking around living in a prison, the worst kind of prison, because, you know, they don't realize they're in prison. They can't even see the bars, and they become a kind of robot of a regime. And, you know, they're no longer in the driver's seat of their life.
Absolutely. And we end up with self-censorship. Last night, in conversation, a friend was saying that she thought that some of the ideas prevalent in the 1970s, I'm talking now about in terms of satire and comedy, are now illegal. Now, she, of course, is mistaken in that view, but that's how far we've traveled in 50 years. That the kind of risque humor, even, which was commonplace in the 1960s and 70s, is now considered dangerous. We're in danger of losing our cultural heritage because it's being edited out of old scripts and things. You know, history is starting to be rewritten in front of our eyes, and that's very, very dangerous, Aaron.
I couldn't agree more. When you have comedians saying that they no longer want to go do stand-up comedy on college campuses, this is not just the loss of, you know, an entertaining diversion in society. Humor, as you suggested a moment ago, is extremely important for social and political life, because it allows us, it's one of the ways that we have of asking questions and challenging the regime. It's done through indirection. It sort of bypasses our critical rationality, in a sense. And, you know, when you laugh at something, it goes sort of right to the heart of what all of us might be feeling, but are, you know, we're not able to articulate. And in every society, I think humor plays a really important political role, even in a monarchy, right, where the king is endowed with all of the social and political power. You still have the role of the court jester, right? The court jester, maybe if he went too far, he would get his head lopped off. But when that social role was functioning correctly, he was able to say things to the king in the presence of the court that other people could not get away with saying, because he did it with humor. And so when our ability to laugh at ourselves, when our ability to engage in political satire is being sort of actively suppressed, this is a very, very bad omen for a free society.
I couldn't agree with you more. To finish, I just want to refer to your terrific essay in Solzhenitsyn's insight that the line between good and evil passes first, neither through classes, nor nations, nor political parties, but right through the center of every human heart. Dr. Aaron Cariati, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks,
on today's
Basil.
News Talk, and I look forward to speaking to you again very soon. I'm Basil
Likewise.
Valentine. I'll be back the same time tomorrow. More after the headlines.